what's come in over lunch? You know, what's landing, what's floating, what's risen, what's fallen? Jackie on her personal microphone.
Yeah, I'm taking it with me.
Nice, nice.
When in life, henceforth and forevermore, I'm going to be loud. I got that last section. I got really, really quiet. In a way, I don't think I ever have before. And I thought, yeah, this is because I'm really tired. But I can get very amped up when I'm tired. And in fact, my normal state is fatigue and insanity. And I was just listening. I wasn't trying to listen. I was just quiet.
Yeah.
And I walked around a little bit at lunch, and I thought, you know, it's not going to be able to hang on to it, not going to be able to conjure it back up. And I thought, but I don't have to do that anyway. It's not something I've got to get. It's what's there.
Yeah.
It's what you've been talking about. Yeah. If it's okay, there's a poem by David White I read this week that knocked me out. It's so much about, it's a fabulous poem and so much about what it is that I've been going through. And now I think I can hear the last line of it more. Can I? It's okay?
Are you? Okay. Here's what I prepared earlier.
Yes.
Okay, it's David White, and it's called The Opening of Eyes. That day I saw beneath dark clouds the passing light over the water, and I heard the voice of the world speak out. I knew then, as I had before, life is no passing memory of what has been, nor the remaining pages in a great book waiting to be read. It is the opening of eyes long closed. It is the vision of far-off things seen for the silence they hold. It is the heart, after years of secret conversing, speaking out loud in the clear air. It is Moses in the desert, fallen to his knees before the lit bush. It is the man throwing away his shoes as if to enter heaven and finding himself astonished, opened at last, fallen in love with solid ground.
Nice. Thank you. I love how we explain peace away. I'm just tired. Yeah. You know, that's why I feel like that.
And you know, what does happen though, sometimes when you're really going fast in your head and you don't know it, and then you start to, like so it always feels to me like I land, you know, like I'm flying an airplane and I just come in for a landing. And when I land, it's like, oh man, I've been tired for a while. You know, and I remember when I first learned this, I got up one day and I could hardly get out of bed. And I called in and I said, I can't come in today, I'm too tired. And I slept for the whole weekend, and I knew that what I was feeling was the tiredness of years. That I'd been just racing in my head for years, and there's kind of a tiredness that you get from psychological busyness that's way more debilitating than a good day's labor, you know? It's just such a draining feeling. But I knew that I had been just racing for so many years, and when I landed, I realized it. Whereas when I was racing, I was always like amping up to get through things, you know, like, okay, I got to get this done. And so I never really got the rest I needed. And so when I first learned this, really, I was sleeping about 5 hours a night, maybe, and not through the night. And then I remember my teacher said, I'm going to go take a nap. I thought, a what? A nap? He goes, oh, yeah, don't you just love to sleep? I said, Not so much. He goes, oh, yeah, you will. You'll love to sleep. I thought, oh, God, save me if I do. And now I do. I just love to sleep. If I, you know, it's like being the first time I felt rested all the way through, it was like such a new experience that I just didn't even remember having it before. And that, to me, like when I get tired now, I get fussy because my tolerance for being in that state of mind isn't very good because I like to feel rested. Yeah. The other thing he did was he came back from a vacation in Hawaii and he started playing Hawaiian music. So I went down with him for my week. I said, oh, God, save me if I start listening to Hawaiian music. So not only do I listen to Hawaiian music, I married a Hawaiian, I live in Hawaii.
But like, on the plus side, God saved her.
It's funny, though, when you're going fast, the things you make be negative are sometimes the things that we need the most. But we resist it.
I've been saved from myself so often where I get on a roll and I get on this momentum, usually writing. You know, like, wow, okay, I just wrote a book. I can write another book. And you know, so far every time I've kind of gotten on one of those rolls, somebody who cares about me and knows has come in and gone, I'm going to take away the pen now. You're going to go have a rest, and we can talk about it again in 2 weeks. And 2 weeks come, and I'm like, oh, thank God I haven't committed to another book. Because you do. You get on a momentum. Mm-hmm. You get on a thought momentum or an activity momentum. And it's like the frogs in the lake, you know, that Chris was talking about last night. You don't notice that the temperature's gotten really hot. And then when you step back into it, it's like, whoa, what was I thinking? Mm-hmm. You know, why did I think that was a good thing? Mm-hmm. But you get used to it. Anything can become normal.
After we had the conference in Minnesota in October, I inadvertently got the opportunity to do much of the work for that. And
elegantly put.
Elegant, yeah. And I came home, and there was still stuff to be done afterwards, you know. And so about the middle of December, I got up in the morning, and I didn't have anything to do. Because normally I was, like, working on stuff in the mainland. You know, when I live here, I got to do my mainland stuff in the morning, and otherwise it's the end of the day by the time I get to it. And I didn't have anything to do. I was like, wow. I have been really using my time very expeditiously. Now what do? I went, oh, I can start exercising in the morning now. This is going to be good. So it's just interesting how all of a sudden it felt like my whole reality shifted again. Like I was really involved with it, really caught, you know, like working on the details. It wasn't bad. I wasn't like in a bad mood or anything, but I was very focused and the job had to be done. And then when it was over with, it was like, oh, yeah. I don't have to do anything. I just have to do my main little work, and that's about it. And it was such a shift again for me. I'd forgotten. I didn't even realize how much I was actually doing.
I mean, I think there's such a... It's so easy to miss the state of mind component of busyness. I remember when I interviewed Jack Canfield for the Hay House World Summit last year, and I don't think this was on air. I think it was beforehand. But I just asked him, I said, you know, are you busy at the moment? And he really thought about it, which I thought was weird. But he did. And he said, you know, I've got a lot on, but I'm not busy. And I got that. Like, I really got that. Because there are times where I have a lot on. There are times where I have less on. There are times where I'm busy. There are times where I'm not. But they don't relate in any obvious way. Mm-hmm. I can be busy with nothing on. I can be completely not busy when I've got a lot on. Mm-hmm. It really is, it's like how much is going on up here? That's what creates the busyness. And that's where the rest will do you a world of good. You know, it'll heal you, it'll restore your performance levels. You know, it will bounce you back from whatever ails you. You know, your resilience is suddenly right there, that your creativity's fresh again. It's that busyness. Being busy in the world, sometimes you will be, sometimes you won't be. Mm-hmm. That's just the world.
Hopefully it's less times than not. Mm-hmm. I used to be busy constantly, overly busy constantly, and I'd get a moment of peacefulness. Mm-hmm. And now I live mostly in peacefulness and then get moments of busyness. And sometimes when there's a project, you get a little bit more. I always think of projects kind of like water in the bathtub. You know, when you start the project, it moves kind of slowly at the other end of the tub. And as it gets closer to the drain, it starts going faster and faster, and the details start swirling until you get done with the project. The trick is to remain floating through the whole thing.
We knew the risks.
No, I'm just seeing that it had never, also had never occurred to me that joy and love are actually quiet things. Mm-hmm. I thought they were something else. I thought they were, I don't know, but I didn't.
Like excitement, you thought they were like excitement? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and when I thought, wait, do I get one free chant?
You're that quiet.
Yeah, and when the excitement wasn't there, something is wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The relationship isn't right, and the thing I'm pursuing isn't. Mm-hmm. It's the wrong path.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Excitement is a tricky thing, you know, because It's a fine thing to have, excitement, but it is the best we can conjure up through our intellect. Mm-hmm. Like that's the best thing, that best feeling you can get by getting something, like having a something to get excited about. The problem is that after you get the first excitement about that, it goes away, and then you have to get something else to get excited about. So you have to keep upping the ante, and you have to keep doing more to keep that excited feeling. But it's that shift from into that state of mind where you can feel those deeper feelings that is the place where gratitude and joy and those deep feelings of love come out of us. Whereas when we're excited, we have to keep coming up with things to be excited about. We kind of get that frenetic energy that goes with it, as opposed to shifting into a deeper state of well-being, and out of that state of well-being come these feelings that are so much deeper. Like the first time, I'd never teared up because I was happy. I saw people doing it, and I thought it was pretty odd. Like I watched TV, like the RCA dog, you know, that person's crying and they're happy. I couldn't get that. And then the first time it hit me that it happened, I was like, oh, this is like love welling up and coming out of my eyes. What an incredible experience this is. And it's just seeing that the deeper feelings are just, there's a range of those deeper feelings as much as the range that we have of the negative feelings. You know, from slightly stressed to majorly distressed, there's a big range of negativity. So when people say I have anxiety, they can have a little bit of anxiety. They can like not be able to function in life because they're so anxious. They can have a little bit of depression, or they can be so depressed they don't want to live anymore. So the range for those deeper feelings are just as great. And that's kind of like, to me, it's like going scuba diving. It's like when you go scuba diving, you know, when you, I don't know, has anybody scuba dived here? When you go down to a deep level, it's really quiet. It's like super quiet down there. And you move really slowly as you're looking at these creatures and beautiful things. And that to me is like the deeper feelings are what you want to be scuba diving into, those feelings, as opposed to thrashing on the top, which is more like excitement. Oh, this is fun, this is, but you got to keep thrashing to keep it going. Whereas if you go deeper, what comes out of you is amazing.
Yeah, it's why I describe, we'll go to Davian in just one sec. It's why I used to describe the feeling that we're talking about as functionally stoned. Because it's like, it is.
I've never been stoned. No, so me neither.
But, you know, from what I read in books, it's you know, it is. It's like there's this sense that actually I can function really well, but it's got that kind of nice feeling behind mm-hmm. it. Go ahead, Davian.
Well, I was going to say, is that why the expression is still waters run deep? Mm. Because they're still, but they're very deep, as opposed to like the surface yeah. rapids.
The babbling brook mm-hmm. yeah. of thought.
Mm-hmm. See, that's what we were talking about this morning, how we get in, like you can tell, I don't know if you could tell this morning, but when we get into that, trying to think about the difference between wisdom and thinking, it's like then we get thinking and we lose that feeling. And it's the more we got to work at something, it's that's a little intellect at work. I call it my little pea brain. Just trying to overachieve. And when we just like let it come out of us and start to look for those deeper feelings. Like I remember when I first went down for my 3-week class, they kept talking about this feeling. I thought, what the heck are they talking about? I mean, I had this huge experience and I, you know, had this great feeling. But what they were talking about, I knew was even more than that. I mean, I thought that was like, no other human being I'd know even had that kind of experience. But I could tell that what they were talking about was something deeper than I had experienced. And it irritated me that I couldn't figure it out. So they just kept telling me, just keep having fun, Chris. Just relax. Go for a walk. And I stayed out at this motel on Key Biscayne, a little bitty hotel. And of course, at the beach was the most beautiful beach in the world, as far as I was concerned. And it was a nice little pool, and that's all I did for 3 weeks, was go to the beach, go to the pool, go to the center, come home, that was it. And after, it took about 2 weeks, and after that weekend, when I got really quiet, when I got tired, and I just slept, the next week, all of a sudden, it was Tuesday morning, I remember it, clear as bell, and I woke up, and I was like, oh, this is the feeling they're talking about. I see it now. And then I started to see it in other people. And so I could like then move in that direction. But it's almost like you have to be open to it and then wait and be patient.
For me, the number of times I've said, oh, this feeling, because mm-hmm. I just forget. I'm not in it, mm-hmm. and I forget that it exists. And that's changed over time. It's less of a lengthy time. It's less completely out of my head and more just dipping a toe. But for me, what it was, it wasn't not knowing how to find it. It was I had no respect for it. I worshipped my intellect and other people's intellect. It wasn't just mine. I mean, I would worship anyone's intellect. Because I was brought up in that church. I mean, that was I was raised to worship it. And so consequently, this feeling that every now and again would show up, well, that's nice. Yeah. You know, I remember my grandmother once. I was in that feeling. And I was probably 19, and I was at home, and I was having a lovely time. And she was like, you know, I was like, oh, isn't life great? She's like, that's nice, dear. You're 19. Go out and do something. Right, and I mean, I was like, oh, right, yeah. You know, because that was what I thought, that was where I thought the juice was.
Yeah.
That's where I thought the good stuff was. That's what I thought life was about. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't really think that. Like, that's what other people thought, and I didn't know, so that seemed like something to go with. Really, I loved that quiet feeling. But I didn't know that was inherent. I didn't know that was important. I didn't know I could live my life from it. I didn't know it had wisdom in it. I didn't know it would guide me. I thought it was a pleasant diversion. And so, I don't know if this is true. This is what's coming to me. I suspect this is true. I bet if I could map it, the amount of time I spend in this deeper feeling and the depth of the feeling is pretty much a direct corollary to how much I value it over time, how much more mm-hmm. important it's become in my world, and how much less important the keenness of my intellect has become. Now, look, I grew up in this church. I don't think it's ever going to go unless it literally goes, right? That's still, I used to try to simplify my writing to make it more accessible. I think in big words. It's just how it comes out. So it's not for me a deadening of it or no, I must beat my brains out with a rock so I can be happy, which I used to think, by the way. There were times where I thought that might be a good strategy. It's just, seemed like a good idea at the time. Right? It's just that I now have such a respect for this place inside me that I get to be in and hang out in more and more of the time. Because I just see it solves every problem. Right? The shout line, they call on the back of a book where you have bits on the back of a book in caps. Right? The shout line for my new book is one problem, one solution, infinite possibilities. And it's that. I've seen that that's really it. Every problem comes back to, I've lost touch with this place. I've gotten caught up in my head, and this looks important, and this looks important, and this looks important. And the further away I am, the more things that look I've got to solve. And yet always, the second I come home to myself, the second I drop back into this, the second thing slowed down enough for it to kind of come back up in me, I'm good. And if there's stuff to do, I do it. And it's extraordinary to me how many times I can fall for the same magic trick. But hey, you know, what are you going to do? Yeah, hi.
It appears to me that from the intellect, that really nice space looks like it's on a level with the problem. So there's that really nice space, but there's also all these problems. Whereas from wisdom, that space is all there is.
Yeah.
And it is, the intellect is not able to comprehend what wisdom is, so it just kind of gives it this spot, but it doesn't know.
I wrote a tip a few months back called something like Asteroid B456. And it was my best attempt at explaining the relationship between my intellect and this space. So you've got a spaceship, and your job is to patrol the asteroid belts. And there's this one asteroid that you hear a lot about, B456, and people kind of talk about it in almost mystical language. Oh, have you been to Asteroid B456? Oh, got to go to Asteroid B4. I remember once when I was younger, I went to Asteroid B456. My life has never been the same. And yet, so at some point when you're flying your spaceship near enough to that, you got to go check it out. And it looks like nothing. It looks like another asteroid. It looks like a barren rock. But you could decide to go in for a closer look. And the second you hit its orbit, everything begins to change. You notice this kind of quiet fill your spaceship. And you notice yourself, and you kind of start to think maybe somebody put some opium in the air ducts or something. And you look down, and this barren rock is lush. And if you have time to go down to the planet and explore it, it is the most beautiful, rich, varied place you've ever seen in your life. But then, because life is life, and you have to get back in your ship, and you go flying, the further away you get from the asteroid, once you break out of its orbit, the more it all feels a little bit like a dream. And when you look back, all you see is the rock, and you start to think you must have made up a lot of those memories and experiences. And so you don't go back there for a while, but then one day life brings you back close to the asteroid, you get into its orbit, and it happens again. And for many years, that was my experience of this. I run into it. It would change my world for a minute or 6 weeks or however long, and then I'd fly back off as if it never happened. And what changed was I started to go, oh, no, hang on. That's my home planet. That's where I'm from. That's why I feel that way when I'm there. Now, it's a metaphor, right? As far as I know. But it is interesting that it doesn't look like anything from the mind, and yet it is everything from the soul. Yeah, you got it.
About a week ago, ran into an old friend, hadn't seen for 6 years. He came over for dinner. We had wine, then he brought wine for dinner, and then we had another bottle of wine. So I overdid it. And the next morning, I woke up feeling terrible. I mean, just rough, rugged, annoyed at myself that I overdid it. But what was fascinating was that my body felt terrible, and I was in such a good mood. I was in such a great space, and I realized I've had this before, but I hadn't had it so clear, the distinction between me and my body, my soul, that space that I was in. While my body felt rugged, I felt fantastic. And it was just really fascinating. And I don't know if you guys have anything to add towards re-inhabiting that space more than what you've already talked towards.
Well, we're going to do a little experiment at the end of the day in the bar at the Fairmont just to see if we can recreate that. But other than that, I don't have anything personally to add.
It was just fascinating to have that experience. And I realized I've touched on that before.
Yeah.
In that space.
We have a lot of exceptions to the rules, don't we, in our mind without realizing it. So it kind of seems like when you're sick, how can you be in a good place? And sometimes it's true, when you're sick, you're not in a good place. I mean, I remember when Sid Banks was in the hospital once in Florida, and one of my friends went up to see him. And so at that time, she was a very sweet, sweet, fragile little flower, she was. And she went up and she said, Sid, she had this problem. She goes, I told Sid about the problem, and he told me what to do, so I went out and did it, and it turned out terrible. It was awful. She said, so I went back up, and I told him, I said, you told me to do this, and it turned out terrible. And he said, well, that's what you get for listening to a sick person. I thought that was funny, but it's true. You know, it's like sometimes you can be in a state like that, and you're like great, and sometimes you're miserable. Doesn't matter, because he was really funny when he died. When he was dying, we asked him, you know, like, because he had cancer, and he had a lot of cancer actually at the end, and he was in a lot of pain. So someone asked him about, like, how are you handling this, Sid? And he said, you know, really, this is just kind of a nuisance getting in the way of me doing my work. And I thought, wow, that's just, it's like he was just focused on doing his work, and that's really all that had bothered him, is that he couldn't, have treatments and be sick and not be able to work on his stuff. And it was just like, it was just a nuisance for him. I thought that was really great.
You know, there's stories of like Gurdjieff, the Russian master, where he would get just rip-roaring drunk and function completely fine. And while everyone else around him was just collapsing. Or Ram Dass tells a story of his teacher, I don't remember his name, taking a couple of, two or four tabs of acid, because Ram Dass thought acid was the way to this state. And you know, just completely unaffected, because not that his body wasn't being affected, not that his brain wasn't being affected. He was used to functioning beyond his body and his brain. So what was going on in his body and his brain was going on. It just, that wasn't the level of consciousness that he operated from. Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't, it was a little distraction. And that's, you know, that's what you're describing, is that capacity in all of us to operate at levels of consciousness beyond the separate self, beyond the body and the brain. It's not that we don't have them. It's not that what... Our bodies are subject to the rules of bodies, and our brains are subject to the rules of brains. But that's not us. That's a part of us. That's a part of our humanness. But it isn't who we are. And that's a fundamentally different thing. And I, personally, I still care what happens to this thing, right? I like taking reasonably good care of it. But it's interesting to me that I'm not as scared about it as I used to be. You know, because it isn't me in the same way as it used to be.
I just had a thought when you just said that.
Yeah.
I'm feeling upset that someone couldn't see me, the real me, beyond maybe some behavior that I had in that moment. But I also realize I can't see me beyond me.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I can't see it. I can't operate beyond the...
Yeah, but you can see it now or you wouldn't have had that insight.
That's one of the things that we talked about when earlier was... who is it? Who's saying about reading the book six times? Is it?
Rich.
Yeah, what's that?
Probably more like 12.
You know, you're saying, yeah, I had to read your book 12 times before I got it. And I was like, no, the fact that you went back and even read it a second time meant you were getting it. It hadn't come to the surface yet. What you've just described, it's not us being nice, saying, ah, but you're already seeing it. It's like, no, the fact that you just clocked that is the beginning of it. And then you start to see more and more, and then you start to literally see it. But it begins at that level of being aware that there's something to be aware of. That's the first seeing. That's the first insight. Mm-hmm. And it's true. It's across the board. It's not, you know, specific to that situation or this. You know, how many of you are here for Elsie or watch the Elsie? Right, Elsie talked about that a lot. Like, she was really, more than I'd ever seen anybody spot, okay, you've started to see it. You know, because you've seen that you're not seeing it. You know, she kept picking it out in people. And I kept going, I started to get eyes for it by the time we were done. It's like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that is happening. That is the beginning of it. And it's cool because you start, you know, once you start to see it, you start to see it everywhere. Once it's tattooed on your eyeballs, it's everywhere you look. Mm-hmm.
Have not had a sense of wisdom before today, and I think this might go back a little bit to the zebras and the elephants. I couldn't see before that they're I just am really seeing the difference between figuring out what you want, deciding what you want, and then strategizing your way towards it. And a calling or directed action that comes from wisdom. They're totally different things. And over here, you don't have to figure anything out or even want anything, actually. It's just your if you're listening to wisdom, you're going to go a certain way. Mm. It's not about figuring it out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it seems to me sometimes that okay, I'm like so conscious that I'm going to over-metaphor everything, but fuck it. So, right, it's like there's a river of gold pouring through us. And we put our hand here and it forms into the shape of a cup, and we put it here and it forms into the shape of a plate, and we put it here and it forms into the shape of a golden elephant. And whatever we touch when that river is flowing through us takes form, and it's all precious. It's made of gold. But when we start to put our attention on trying to create that thing, the gold stops flowing. And so it's this weird thing, but it's two different things.
Yeah.
Once the form starts becoming the important bit, the flow stops. As long as the flow is the important thing, it can take an infinite number of forms. And that's the richness of life. It flows through us. And one of the ways we lose it is by getting caught up in it should look like this.
Actually, that's a really good example of what happens when people get married. They meet each other and they have no thoughts about each other, and you know, they'll sit and talk and listen to each other for hours and hours at end. You know, it's like Jerry Seinfeld, the show about nothing. And that's what happens when you fall in love. You just can talk forever. You don't even care what the other person's saying. You just are so grateful to be on the phone with them, you know, or in the same room with them. And then you think, okay, I love you, let's get married. You get married, and then about 3 to 4 years later, you're trying to get them to change so that you can be happy again. You know, because people just get tricked into thinking that when they're in a good feeling, that somehow the other person created that. So if you made me feel good, and I don't feel good now, you must be making me feel bad, and this is what you're doing that's causing that. And that's really how we take it away from ourselves. Yeah.
That was actually, can I segue from that? Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm going to ask you to segue from that, but I'm going to tell you what I mean. Mm-hmm. Is because where I thought it would be really nice to go is in terms of we're talking about falling in love with life, but let's talk about falling in love with each other. And as it happens, Chris has written a new book about this.
Yeah. It's going to be called The Power of Love, Unlocking the Mystery and Unleashing the Magic. So we're going to, hopefully it'll be done in a couple months. Most of it's done, but we kind of have a combination of, Sid did a tape called Thought and Marriage, and we both got really touched by it because we're both marriage and family therapists. And I wrote it with Laura Carpenos. And we were so touched by that, we decided we'd kind of like take Sid's wisdom and then have stories about how people have changed and as they've learned the principles, and then kind of have a little discussion about what that is. So that's kind of the format for the book. And hopefully it'll be good. So you have to let me know if you get it, like it.
So in putting it together, you know, what have you seen? Because that's the thing I know about when you work on a book. Suddenly you start seeing more and more about that.
Yeah, you know, I think that what impresses me is how easily we give up love, and how easily we get the idea that we can get divorced, or you know, that we should fix the other person, and just many ways how we kind of contaminate something that happens without effort. You know, it's like when you fall in love with somebody, generally not even trying. It's like you just love the person and they love you, and you have this beautiful feeling between the two of you. And how quickly we'll let that go because they don't show up on time, or they are busy working and not with us all the time, or whatever it is. And then we start, our addiction to negative thinking just comes in, and pretty soon what was a beautiful experience turns into something that needs to be fixed. And so what I've seen is that really couples don't need to have help to fix their marriage. What they need help with is to live in a state of mental well-being and not blame it on their partner, the good or the bad. It's like really helps people to go deeper. So different thing, you know, we've interviewed a bunch of people that have been around in the principles for years and years, and how their relationship changed. And one of the things that we realized after we did it is that a lot of the people, the way the story sounds now, it's like, oh yeah, well, we didn't see things very well in the past, and we learned the principles, and now we're all happy. And it was like that was the story over and over and over again, so we had to like spice it up a little bit. Because yeah. Most of the people that we interviewed were like, it's kind of like almost like you forget what it was like when you were really in a bad place, which is good. You want to forget that, but it's hard to get a good juicy story that
this explains
changes.
Chapter 7 when the aliens invade Earth.
Yeah.
Just needed to kind of bring a little drama back in.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So hopefully it'll help. I know that there are things that I, as I was working with people, I would think, oh, I wish I had something to give them that they could read about this. Well, we were talking about something they could take home, and then it was like, oh, if I had my book done, I could give them chapter 6. This would be really good for them. So I think it'll be good.
Yeah.
I'm excited about it.
I was wondering if you had a book. Is this your only book?
It is my only book that's written. I have another book. I've had to wait until my stepchildren are old enough to laugh, because the title of it is How to Be Hated and Still Keep Your Self-Esteem, the guide to Step-Parenting. So I thought that would be a good book. It's a good title anyway. I don't know that I'll ever write the book, but... Yeah. Yeah, that'd be a chapter, the wonder years. You wonder if you'll live, you wonder if they'll live, you wonder why you had kids.
Yeah. You wonder if it'll be that you killed them?
Yeah, or... yeah, that's right.
Yeah, no, you can speak with that. It just literally, Jackie's just a little soft. That's her mic.
It's your mic. So we were talking about that flow, we were talking about the creating and when you just let it be. It's interesting how simple things that we don't put emphasis on, flow. Mm. Like, I can clean my house if it feels good. If it feels good, I'll clean it. If it doesn't feel good, I don't. And it happens more often that it just feels good, so I do it. Or when we're talking about relationships, I think you said, Michael, before, the story about how easy it is to talk to someone on an airplane, because you have no attachments. There's nothing, it's just, you meet them for a couple of hours and then they're gone. Like, it's just so easy. But when we want something in life, like money or the love of life, like, it doesn't seem to work. Because there's just too much emphasis on it. We want it so badly that we're too impatient to wait for it, or we think it's the end of the world if it doesn't work out the way we think or the way it's been projected all around us, or I guess what we learn. And so I think that's the hard part. Easy things flow, what we consider easy, but what we really want and place emphasis on doesn't.
Well, and I think it's because the value culturally is on the output, not the flow. And the flow is actually where the juice is. And so it just seems to me to be the easiest mistake in the world. Because it's like, well, I can see the output. I can't see the flow. So it must be that. And the fact that it just isn't, don't let that stop you. You know.
You know, last night, you had a question.
Oh, no, it was just something that had come up was a few months ago, if you'd said there was anything wrong with my marriage, I would have been like, no, I've got a great marriage. You know, everything's great. And as I've, I don't know, grounded more into this space or understanding, my relationship has gone back to where it was when we first met and dated in terms of just loving being around her, laughing a lot more, enjoying her company in a way that I hadn't realized things had maybe ossified a little bit, gotten a little kind of hard, not hard, but just not as flowy. It's sort of like, in turning on my own faucet on that flow, little by little, it's opened up her faucet, because she's, as yet, not really into the principles. And yet, she's becoming more and more into it just by virtue of how we are together, which is crazy cool and quite amazing. I don't know if that's something you've experienced in researching your book, that like one person who's not principles related and the other one starts going down that path, and then it just suddenly rubs off on them, kind of.
Well, it's really hard to live with somebody who is calm and happy and not catch it, because it's innate in all of us.
Yeah.
And so without realizing it, people start feeling better. I mean, that's what happens in therapy. People come in and I'm in a good place and they leave and they feel better and we talk about the day and that's about it. Then they get in a nice feeling and I point it out and they go home and they come back the next week and they're better. So it's just really kind of, whether you're helping to teach this to somebody or you're just living with somebody in your life, if you're in that feeling, it works like a draw to draw the feeling out of other people.
Yeah. What's also fascinating is things that previously would have really set me off, case in point, my 5-year-old graduated from preschool Friday morning. And I videotaped it, you know, and I do this stuff. But somehow, because I wanted to save the battery because I thought it might be low, I didn't turn on the microphone battery, so we didn't get any audio. Oh. She was furious that I didn't record the sound. And her being mad at me previously would have really set me off. And I was just like, yeah, I made a mistake. It's okay. I'll get audio from somebody else and we'll lay it back in. And she kept wanting to be mad about it. And I was like, okay, well, you can be mad about it, but it's no longer a problem because I can fix it. Mm-hmm. Do you understand it can be fixed? Yes. All right, well, when you're done. And I just was like easy with it. Yeah. Without it being, previously that probably would have been, I'd get mad at her and then she'd feel my tension and then it would just and amp up. And then we'd spend a day or two kind of not talking to each other or mm-hmm. being a little tense around Quickly. Each other until it finally would go away. Mm-hmm. But it just never got there. It just mm-hmm. didn't happen in the way it traditionally might have. That was, I keep doing that where I'm like, oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. See, that's a really good example of it, because it's like if you change on the inside, you're not going to be consciously changing what you're doing. Like you just change on the inside, so it seems like you're being you, but what you say sounds totally different from what you would have said in the past. But you don't realize that because you're still just being you. And then after it's over, it's like, oh, who is that? Who said that? Oh, me. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the fun. It's so fun when that happens, isn't it? It's like, because you realize, oh, I've changed.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, then her upset with me quickly dissipated. Mm-hmm. And I got she was upset, and I totally understand why she was upset. And I was like, yeah, I messed up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I still need to sort that out. Mm-hmm. But it was like, it's sort outable. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't personal.
No, no.
Yeah, it was just part of life. You just screwed up. Big deal.
No, and I started to want to get bothered that she was bothered with me. Mm-hmm. And then kind of went, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, don't need to do that. So it didn't happen.
I mean, we always have, almost everyone I know has somebody who just gets a free pass. It's often not your spouse, but there's somebody in your world who gets a free pass. Like, if they do anything short of murder your children, oh, that's just Davey. Yeah. You know, and if he did murder one of the kids, it was probably an accident.
Yeah.
You know, and yet other people are held to a standard. Well, there's an incredible value to that place of the free pass. I don't mean actually, I'm not saying about accountability, but that there is a place in us where we flow with life. And we flow with what happens. And there's a wisdom in that place that will stop things before they murder our children. You know what I mean? It's not actually about not taking responsibility for your actions or anything like that. It's just recognizing, I don't need to be judge and jury. I don't need to live in this relationship as judge and jury. I can just be in relationship. And I've got this wisdom in me that will guide me, and if there's something that needs accounting for, it will be accounted for. But in the meantime, I can just be in the relationship. I can be on the airplane with them. I don't have to make it right. And, oh my God, the pressure that takes off everyone's plate. You know, it takes off my plate because I'm no longer having to be really on it and make sure that I keep you in line, right? But also, it's really nice to be with somebody who isn't sitting there waiting for you to slip up so they can go, ha ha! You know, that's it. You were on probation, double secret probation, and now you're out. You know, and it's because we feel it. We absolutely feel it. Yeah, go ahead, Wendy.
I felt a lot of times like I was on probation with myself. So what I've been noticing is, you know, so then those old feelings come back. So a few nights ago, I got that depressed feeling all through my body. I got up in the middle of the night, which I do often at this age. and I just like, oh, here it is again. And I almost went into like the, oh, you don't learn anything, you suck, and blah, blah, blah. And I just kind of opened my eyes. I kind of want to qualify this because it might happen. So I just was in the depression for a minute. I opened my eyes and I just shined a light on it. Like I just looked at it and it just went away. I mean, I can't even still believe because I had struggled with so many years. And I don't know that it's not going to happen later and it won't go away, but just knowing that that happened once, you know, it,
Well, yeah. You do know that there's no such thing as depression.
Provocative gauntlet laid down.
There's not like a thing. Like when you get the flu, you get a virus. There's not like a thing called depression.
Yeah, talk more about that. Because I could look back on times where it was like a whole 4 months, even after the principles, where it's 4 months of depression. And it just was such an awful place. Mm-hmm. It's scary to think that I could ever go back there. So
Well, that was just the state of mind you were in, and the symptoms that you were producing because of the way you were using the gift of thought was that you were creating stress and therefore depressed feeling. But there's not an illness called depression that you can get or get over. It's a moment-to-moment thing that you're creating with your thinking. And the more you focus on it, the more symptoms you create, and the more real it gets. And the more real it gets, the more it becomes a thing that inhabits your body. Or almost like this kind of a, sometimes even like a safe place. I call it the seduction of depression, where you like, oh, yeah, I forgot I'm depressed again. It's like, over here, come over here. And then you kind of go into that place like, oh, yeah. And it's like, oh, yuck, what is this? Because it's just a way of thinking where you're looking at life as being a negative experience for you. There are also no such thing as anxiety. I'll tell you how these things came to be. Okay, you had a bunch of doctors that got together, okay, and they sat down and they said, I see a lot of patients that come in with these symptoms. Some of them are, they're crying all the time, or they're so depressed they can't get out of bed, or blah, 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 okay? And then they said, and I got a bunch of clients that come in and they can't sleep because their mind is going so fast and they're fearful of everything and they've got this anxiety, right? And then, oh, we got these other guys up here that kind of see double. They create more than one reality at a time and kind of have these psychotic episodes. And then there's this group over here that we really can't see that there's anything wrong with them, but their thinking is so bad. They really irritate other people easily and they get in lots of problems in their life. So they said, okay, well, let's call this group of people that have these symptoms, we'll call them depressed. We'll call that, we're treating their depression. And then this group of people, we'll call this that we're treating their anxiety. And these guys will be psychotic kinds of mental illnesses. And these will be personality disorders. That's how it started. It's not like there's a virus you get. It's just a way of thinking. And because we're all very similar in how thought works, we create similar symptoms. So you can't, like, your depression isn't like stalking you. You're like walking around waiting to get in your body again. It kind of feels like that, though. It's like, oh, there it is again. I the first week that I learned this, I woke up in the middle of the night with the worst nightmare I'd had in years. and I was sweating and crying and gripping the covers and sat straight up in bed. And I went, oh, it's come back. My craziness has come back. And then my wisdom said, it's just a dream, and dreams are just thoughts. It's not real. I went, yeah, that's right. Dreams are just thoughts. Oh, my gosh. I'm fine. It was the last real nightmare I ever had. I had one more that happened with, and in the nightmare, this guy, I was always having dreams of people chasing me and men chasing me. And this guy was coming at me with a knife. And in the dream, I said, oh, this is a dream. It'll change in a minute. And the guy just like disappeared. It's just all thought, see? Just very dramatic thought.
And one thought seems to follow on from the mm-hmm. next. I remember one of my first coaches and the principal's telling me that she used to suffer from, from long periods of depression. You know, and she'd go into these three to five day funks where she, you know, lights out in bed, shades drawn, you know, drop out of life till it passed. And when she learned about the principles, in a great place, and then a couple weeks it started, and she gathered up her tissues and she gathered up her thing and she drew the blinds and she kind of had, so about 20 minutes later she kind of noticed that she was up doing the dishes because she got bored. And it was such a surprise because she just thought, oh well, when I feel this, that's going to mean that, and that's going to mean this, and then it's going to go here. And there was a whole chain of thinking. And when as soon as one thought, one link in the chain broke, one thought looked like thought, the whole thing fell apart. And this is the thing for me, okay, as somebody who used to think I had the disease, is part of why I think I left all the breadcrumbs and had all the little reminders and everything was so that if it came again, I would be able to handle it better. It wouldn't eat me alive. And then it did. And it was okay. It was the most surreal experience of being depressed without it being depressing. I physically had all the symptoms, but it was fine. It was odd. It was slightly disconcerting to have both those things going on at the same time, a bit like what David was talking about with being hungover and fine. I was depressed, but I was fine. And I just at the conference, Mark Howard and I gave a talk about anxiety, depression, and addiction. And my students, who's a doctor, came up and told her story about getting depressed and not being in it, like having it but it not having her. And she said she suddenly realized, oh, this is like when somebody hurts their knee. There's pain. There's pain in the body as the body heals itself. But it's not a problem inherently. And that somehow she had seen that with physical symptoms, but she'd never realized the same was true of thought. So yeah, you will have thoughts that bring on feelings that are really unpleasant. And then they'll change, because that's what thoughts do. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a thing, well then you've got to deal with the thing. Mm-hmm.
And when you're in the throes of that thinking, I'm not diminishing how much you suffer by saying that. But if you want to let go of it, you have to see that that's all it was. It's all it ever is. So you don't have to worry about it.
And you don't have to protect yourself.
Yeah. It's not like it's cancer and it'll like come back.
Well, I've got that too. And when you were just talking, I don't know what you said, but I thought cancer for me right now isn't even like what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, wow, I'm living my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little, it's a little different
mm-hmm.
than it was a few months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really kind of seeing that the state of mind you're in will help with anything, everything. Whether it's a death of a spouse or an illness that you have or a house that goes up in fire or, anything that we go with, when we're in that state of mind, it goes easier. Now, would you want to do it again? Probably not. You know, there are some things that we go through that are gut-wrenching and awful and test us to the max. But when you know that even though that's happening, you're still okay inside, you, like, to me, I always think that, like, my middle stepson got leukemia and died when he was 25. And getting through that, knowing that on the inside I was titanium, that I could go there and be safe, and then I could help him. You know, because if I got caught up in my thinking about it, it was like, this is going to happen, oh, that might happen, and it was up and down all the time. So I just knew that I had to connect with that strength that was in me and stay right there, that was the best I could do. And that would help him more than anything. And that's where you go. You go there, and then whatever's going to happen, you can't control. I mean, Sid Banks died of cancer, so, you know, it's like we have no guarantees in life, but the best thing you can do is to be in that place inside. And all that of the thinking about being sick, you got to let that go. You don't have to, but it'll be nicer if you do. Because that's your freedom. See, that to me, when I saw that my depression was me using my thinking in a way it wasn't designed, I was like, wow, I am free. I never have to be depressed again a day in my life. And I haven't been. I've been sad, but not depressed. Very different. But the way, I mean, everybody gets caught up with mental health diagnosis. The current one for the last 10 years is bipolar. Everybody knows somebody that's bipolar, right? Suddenly, it became like the diagnosis of choice. But I just don't pay attention to those. I mean, I do to get insurance reimbursement. I say, okay, this person manifests symptoms that are depressive. This person's manifesting symptoms that are anxiety disorder. But I don't pay attention to that. It doesn't mean anything to me. And what I do with people is I really help them to see that that's just a result of them inadvertently using their thinking in ways it wasn't designed for. Trying to figure out the unknown. Trying to change things you have no control over. And that when we come back and we live our life and we just take life as it comes and do the best we can, that's all you can do. That's good. That's enough. And when you're in that feeling, then you can get through anything. And you've got that strength and you've got a good nose for it, because that's what you're already like on this journey, so you know that. So just forget about that time in your life when you felt depressed. It's gone. Forget it. Sid said that he told me this just before he died, as a matter of fact. And he said, Chris, once you're out of it, stay out of it. Don't be thinking about it anymore. So if you're out of that state of mind, don't be thinking about how, oh, I was really caught up last week. Because then now you're bringing it back to life again. Just forget about it. It's done and over with. Like if you have an insight in this moment, then from now on, just keep living in this moment, in the now. However you felt last week doesn't, or last year, 20 years ago, doesn't matter anymore. For the longest time, I could not talk about my past for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, really much, because I get talking about my mother or something that, and it would get real again. So I just had to stay out of it, because I had plenty of material in the present. I was learning a lot. There was a lot there. I didn't have to worry about how I felt before. And I realized that was really my saving grace, because I stopped identifying myself with that person. I stopped identifying myself as a depressed person, as a loser, I had like several conversations.
That would be really nice to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just what you created before. It's not real. Just the creative power of our own thinking. Judy Sedgman, my friend Judy Sedgman said, She was playing with her grandson one day, and they were making hand puppets, you know, and she said, we were making these really scary hand puppets, and she said, I just got to thinking that that's a little bit like what we do with thought, is we make this really scary hand puppet, and then we forget about it, and we're walking along in life, and every once in a while we go, ah! We scare ourselves half to death. Physical addictions, you mean a way of treating your anxiety? Yeah. Dr. Pettit says that, 30% of the people that see him for anxiety, he tells them to get off caffeine and the anxiety goes away. So I get, just stop using caffeine, that'd be the easy way. But see, this is the deal. When you're anxious, you're having fearful thinking about, usually about the future. Sometimes, like guys in prison, they have fearful thinking that they're going to get caught for a crime they did in the past. So it's the future, but it's really about something they did in the past. They think they're going to get caught again. So, but it's, you know, anxiety is living in fear. And so it comes from different things. Like sometimes people think that they're unlovable. And so any minute now, people are going to find out Well, you were here last night. I talked about the, at MIT, they have an imposter syndrome where kids that go to MIT start to feel like there's a mistake. They shouldn't have been accepted there because they think everybody else is smarter than them. You know, because before they're the valedictorian of their class, and now they're with all the other valedictorians, so they think there's something wrong with them and there's been a mistake. Well, most of us who have anxiety walk around thinking that people are going to find us out, that we're really not lovable, not competent, not smart, not something, that we're an imposter walking around, and people will find that out. So we worry about negative things happening in the future. And, you know, worry is our ability. It's like we're trying to be in control of something that doesn't exist. Because worry is always about the unknown. It's not happening. Nobody worries about whether, like, I'm not worrying about this chair falling apart.
Well, I wasn't.
Yeah. So whatever you're doing, see, when people get anxiety, they generally have other habits that go along with it. So sometimes people might use alcohol or drugs. Sometimes you might be a gambler. Sometimes you might be addicted to sex. You might be doing all kinds of things. But whatever you're doing to try to calm yourself down, that's like your mental health at work. Because you know at one level that being in that anxious feeling is not normal. So you're trying whatever, and things will temporarily work because you stop thinking about whatever you're thinking about. And while you're doing that, so like, let's say you gamble and you, like the first time I went with my husband to the casino, I was doing the slot machines and he was playing cards. And I was putting, you know, I'm so cheap, I was putting like one quarter in and so I got 3 sevens, right? And I was so excited, I went running back to my husband, go, honey, I got 3 sevens. He goes, oh good. How many quarters did you put in? I said, oh, just one. He goes, no, you have to always put in the full amount. But I was so excited about the fact that I got 3 sevens, it didn't matter to me how much money I put in. But what happens is somewhere along the line, we do something and we get a better feeling, and then we blame that feeling on what we did. So we keep doing that over and over and over again as a way to try to feel better. So that's what causes an addiction to that kind of thinking, is you're trying to think your way out of your thinking.
No, I got that. I mean, I've accepted like everything that's happened in my past. I have this repeating message that I'm an idiot because that's what happened in my childhood, just being called out over and over and over again. I believed it. Mm-hmm. And finally, working with the coach, it woke me up to not believing that anymore. And I know, like, there's certain things, like, if I'm hiking all day long, I'm able to take less medication. But I notice even when I'm not, like, thinking about anything, out of nowhere, I'll get some physical addiction, so it has to be something still there, right, to that medication, like withdrawals. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, that times where it's been like a day or two when I just completely would freak out, like not be able to function or go to work.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't matter whether you take medication or not. Don't be focused on that. Just start to see if you can just keep noticing that you're thinking. That's all it is, you're just thinking. And so the more you see that and the quieter you get as a result of the insights you get, the more you'll see what to do about the medication. But right now, you probably still might need to take the medication.
It's been 10 years, so it's like, better stop taking it.
Well, this would be a good time then to, I mean, you can certainly get off the medication, but don't do it until you get some understanding of it or you set yourself up again. You go, see, I'm a failure, look at that. I couldn't do it without medication. So just really take it easy, because it doesn't matter. You'll get into a better place. I mean, I have clients come in all the time that are medicated, and I don't care one way or the other, but I'll say, oh, by the way, are you still taking medication? No, I stopped taking that a month ago. I don't need that anymore. And I'm like, you're supposed to be telling me about these things. Oh, my God, you know, but you'll know, you'll know if and when it's the right time. Up until that point, just forget about it. And just work on having a nice life.
Years ago, I'd never be able to come to something like this.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, this is the complete layperson point of view. But the only thing I heard in what you said that I recognized and went, oh, I know that one, is I wasn't even thinking anything. Oh, yeah, you were. We live in a world of thought. It's not just those thoughts that we notice that are creating our experience. We live in a flow of thought. And that's what makes it seem like, oh, no, maybe this bit's real. Maybe this bit is physical. Because we just don't see the thought. And it's not that it matters what the individual thought is. Like, there was a phrase that George Pransky used to use. And I'm, by the way, I'm conscious. We'll take a break in a minute, and then we'll come back for one last set. But thought recognition. And I thought that meant spotting which thought created which feeling. Mm. And so I immediately decided, okay, this is something I can get good at. So I would notice a feeling and then trace it back to the thought that created that feeling. And I was like, I called it thought spotting. And you know, I got really into it. And yeah, I was busy, you know, what can I say? But what changed was I started to see that it was simply recognizing that we were in thought. Wasn't spotting a particular thought that created a particular thing that I could then change. It was just kind of beginning to recognize, oh, this is a symptom of thought. Oh, this is a symptom of thought. Oh, this is what happens when you're thinking. And it made the world stop dividing up into, well, these are things that thought helps with, and these are things that physical, it stopped being two different worlds that I was trying to treat individually. And it's just, how far down the chain is the treatment coming in? You know, how far into the effect am I trying to do damage control? Mm-hmm. And for me, I personally have no problem with what people do for damage control, because it's what they found to do. It's just that if they keep doing the damage without ever looking upstream to see where that's coming from, well, then they're going to have to keep doing the damage control, and over time, what they do for damage control is going to create a different kind of damage. Mm-hmm. And that's why, that's the power of looking upstream, of looking back towards the projector. And you're like, oh. And at some point, like Christine says, my experience has been with all my clients with addictions, which is, you know, a fair whack. They just know what to do with it, and they find their way. But the idea, I have to get off this, that becomes a whole other game. Mm. Let's take a break. Let's take 15 minutes. We'll come back.
and then we'll go till we're done, 4 or 5, whichever comes first. So take a break. Go ahead.